welcome Dan McClure on this very first episode of what might be the SOLIDWORKS podcast at some point. Why don't you start about and tell us who you are and what you're doing for SOLIDWORKS?
Yeah. So basically, I'm a guy who couldn't get a job doing anything else besides innovating. I started out my career with a degree in engineering and lasted about 4 weeks as an engineer before I started going rogue and doing innovation at the large utility company I was working at. And I was lucky that the entire industry got deregulated right about that time, and all of a sudden they needed an innovator. And I've never really looked back since then. So I've been doing innovation for 30 years. Part of that time making elephants dance, you know, big organizations doing innovative things that they normally don't do. I've had my own company, so I've done the whole Inc. 500 award thing. And most recently I joined ThoughtWorks about 4 years ago because I think there's an enormous opportunity right now to bring innovation, business innovation, design, and technology together. And the ThoughtWorks folks represented like a great platform on which to build any kind of dreams and aspirations of technology.
When you say innovation, what do you mean by that?
So it's interesting that people have a hard time with this, but I think it's partly because it's been co-opted by so many different types of folks. So early on, innovation in the 1970s and 80s was all around factory innovation, Deming's models of how to optimize factory performance. And that's really innovation about taking an operation and making it just a little bit better. It's really about doing the same thing, but just a little bit better. In reality, the innovation that matters today is about doing brand new things, bringing new value to the marketplace. So if you can think of yourself as saying, I have a certain value in the marketplace now, how do I create a new value that's distinct and different from what I've already been able to bring?
Mm-hmm. And what could this innovation be?
Well, it can be anything, because what it really is, it's the ability to create new value. So a musician creates new value by coming up with new kind of music. A accountant creates new value by providing new services in accounting. A chef creates new value by inventing a better recipe or by offering it in a new form, you know, new restaurant.
So is everyone an innovator?
Anybody can be an innovator who creates new things that people want. That's really what you're talking about, is finding something that matters to people.
So when I look at the publication recently, especially when I look at business management information, it seems like innovation is something which is a hype theme. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think it certainly has all the signs of hype, right? You can't like turn your head or throw a stone without hitting something with innovation on it. And the danger of that, of course, is that you're going to assume it's just like all the other management hypes, you know, the management by objectives or, you know, the other kinds of like things that we're going to save an organization's management team. This is different because it's at the root of a fundamental economic change. And that economic change is not something that's going to go away just because we're at the end of a hype cycle.
What is this economic change?
So currently we live at the tail end of an industrial era economic model. And the way that works is you do some initial investment up front, you pay out a little bit of money to create a new value proposition. Maybe you've got an R&D department or some other kind, you buy up an invention from somebody.
And then like inventing a car.
Well, so it'd be more like you invent a piece of a car or, you know, you invent some new tool that people use. And the key part is that that invention is followed by a long period of harvesting. So you spend a lot of time figuring out how to make more money out of that one invention. And you become very good at operating and sort of milking the money out of that invention. We're not having the opportunity anymore to harvest those inventions for a long period of time. So we need to invent or innovate more often. And that's what's changed.
How do I do that? How can I innovate more?
So there are a couple of key techniques. The first thing to realize is what good innovation looks like. And good innovation that matters in the coming economy has three key traits. One, it's something that you do repeatedly. Two, it's something that's original and unique. You know, the idea of creating something that is basically the same as what other people do, the fast follow model, that's not going to cut it anymore. Got to be original and unique. And then the third piece is that it's got to matter to somebody in the marketplace. So that's what you're really looking for. Something.
Can you highlight this with a concrete example of your past?
Well, so I think, you know, there's a lot of examples of innovation that were unique and original, but were not necessarily desired by the marketplace. I come out of Detroit, and one of the classic stories out of Detroit is the Edsel car, which had all the latest innovations ladled on top of it, but actually wasn't the kind of car that anybody wanted to buy. So even though it was the most technically advanced car that Ford had ever made at the time, nobody wanted it.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on it? Because I'm German and I have no clue about cars.
Ah, sure you do. I know this because we've got competition from BMW. And so, yes. The Edsel was a car that was designed in the late 50s. And there was a period of increased stylistic invention. So bigger fins, new technologies around radios, et cetera, being added into cars. And this was sort of like the apotheosis of that, where you had all these things piled onto one car. And what it came down to was sort of like the television remote that has all the possible features you could ever want, or the dishwasher that has more buttons than you could ever want. That kind of innovation ended up not being something that people actually wanted to buy. You had gone past the point where it mattered in the marketplace. So, and then examples of innovation, which are ordinary and simple copies, you see those every day. You know, you look at, you know, types of technologies that get released into the marketplace, and somebody tries to come on, you know, with just a slightly cheaper version.
Do you have a good example of true innovation?
So I think we all kind of know it when we see it. So the iPhone, when it came out, was a true innovation. What was interesting about it is the true innovation was actually a series of things piled on top of each other. It was a phone plus the internet combined together. But the real kicker on it was that it had an ecosystem that drew you in and tied you by allowing you to buy music, listen to music, connect your emails into other types of contact. And so what Steve Jobs' real brilliance there for all the design and everything was that he innovated a new ecosystem. Anything that creates an original type of value for folks is going to be that kind of, you know, differentiator in the market.
Okay. That's interesting. One thing I'm wondering, because innovation has kind of happened always, so why is this so much more important today?
It's a combination of four things that have all hit at once. So first off, we've got this exponential increase in the amount of technology. We're used to the idea of technology doubling every couple of years for things like computing power. And as a result, it doesn't shock us that we've got an iPhone that actually has more capabilities inside that one phone than NASA had for the entire space program when they went to the moon. But this seems kind of normal to us, and we've gotten kind of used to it. What's happening, though, is that all the technologies we have are following this pattern. Our ability to read the genome is going up exponentially. Our ability to create patents is going up exponentially. Our communication bandwidth is growing up exponentially. So we have a bigger toolkit than we've ever had before, and the toolkit keeps growing. The second piece is that we've got a lower cost of invention as a result of that. So now, instead of having to spend millions of dollars to invent some idea, you can invent a billion-dollar idea in your garage. Just ask Palmer Luckey with his Oculus Rift. You know, before he was able to drink, he had actually created a technology invention that was worth $2 billion. That's pretty good. And it's not because he was, you know, the son of a billionaire. You know, he was able to do it at relatively low cost. The third thing is that we've got an explosion in the number of people who can innovate. It's amazing just trying to wrap your mind around how many smart, passionate people are out there now. If you think about Renaissance Florence, there was like 100,000 people when they were reinventing the entire Western culture. We graduate four times that many technologists out of India just in 1 year. So it's like every 3 years we're making a new Renaissance Florence. That's amazing. And then finally, all of those people with that low-cost innovation and that big toolkit can get to market cheaply. And so it's possible to bring ideas to market faster and quicker than ever before. And that means more old ideas become obsolete faster.
So how does this fast pace of innovation affect us?
Well, the first thing it does is it means that we can't live by harvesting one big investment that we did years ago. I think the most obvious example of that is if you have a college degree. You go and you get a college degree, you spend a lot of money, you spend 4 years in college, it's a lot of time out of your life. The old model was you did that up in the beginning of your life, and then you basically worked your career for the rest of for the next 30 years. That's not going to work anymore. The things that you learned in college, there are some core skills you may have, but basically the knowledge that you learn, that's going to be obsolete in just a few years. So you can't invest big and then expect to harvest for a long time. And that's going to be true in business too. So we're going to have to figure out how to reduce our investment in innovation and how to invest, how to invent more often.
So how would I do with that? How can I learn to invest less and invent more?
Yeah, well, so there's a lot of cool techniques that are being developed around this, but I'll be honest with you, we don't know the answer to this yet. And this is the thing that both excites and terrifies me. In one way, there's nothing more important than figuring this out, because if we don't, we're going to find that our investments are made obsolete too quick, and we're not going to be able to survive economically as businesses or as individuals. But at the same time, we don't know how to do it very well. So if while it's exciting to explore it, we don't really know how to do it, and we could be hit by a bus, which doesn't answer the question at all. So let me jump into the answer to the question of how we actually do it. Let me throw out one thing. The first thing we do is we have more ideas coming in. So we stop thinking about our lives or our businesses as one investment type things. We have lots of ideas that we bring in, and we're constantly evaluating multiple ideas. So we open the gate to more ideas.
So rather than investing in one huge idea, 2 million euros, you would invest 100,000 euros into 20 ideas.
Yeah, so you invest 100,000 euros in 20 ideas, and there you've got the danger of the baby bunnies. So you can have lots of little ideas that all get at their 100,000 euros. And if that's all the further you've gone, you haven't made an investment that can pay you back. You've just made a bunch of baby bunnies. And there's a lot of organizations that are actually doing that right now. They've gotten very good at making baby bunnies. What you need is a way to identify which of those ideas is best and then be able to move it forward. So the skill is not only just having the ideas, but being able to say, I'm going to test and learn on each of these ideas, and then pick the ones that are worthy of additional investment, that perhaps need to be pivoted and changed so that they could be more effective, or, quite frankly, recognizing the ones that need to be killed off. We should be killing baby bunnies on a regular basis.
Quite scary.
Only for the baby bunnies.
So it sounds a lot like you want a company to be a lot of lean startups. Is that what you want to go to?
Yeah, so that's part of it. You definitely need to be thinking like a lean startup. You can't stop by thinking as a lean startup, though. So lightweight testing, lightweight prototyping, all of these things are typical of lean startups. You need to be able to take the idea through to maturity so that it actually does get to the marketplace. And that's where you need a deeper set of skills. So I mentioned earlier on that I joined ThoughtWorks because I was excited about the potential of bringing together technology, strategy, and design. And that's the kind of powerhouse that you need to make these ideas grow up beyond their initial starting stage. And so you need not only a way to test an initial idea, but a way to grow ideas very quickly, because the market life cycle is going to be short. You can't afford to delay.
Are all the innovations you're talking about software innovations?
No, actually, software you should think of as like a really great tool. Sort of like if you're going to be a carpenter, having a really good saw is useful, but it's not like that's the only thing you do or the only thing you use. Software is really good for innovation because it's easy to pivot and change. It is easy to scale up. But there's a lot of innovation right now that's being done across multiple dimensions. So software, hardware, and in some cases, the line begins to blur. There's an organization right now that has community sourced the designs for prosthetic hands. And so they gather them from around the world in digital designs of prosthetic hands. They then take a prosthetic hand, a plastic printer to a refugee camp. They can print the hands in the refugee camp and then use them and then basically customize them to fit people who are in, you know, very, very dire straits. So is that software? I don't know. There's a software component to it, but there's a very physical component, and there's even a services component around it. I think that's what we're going to find is software is a piece of a bigger solution.
So, software is kind of in the heart of the solution.
Well, I think software is in the heart of a lot of solutions. Interestingly enough, my son is in the business of making custom carpentry tools. So he doesn't actually use a whole lot of software, but he uses a lot of advanced technology to make these individual handcrafted saws and tools. So it's not necessary. Remember, innovation is about creating new value. Software is great, but it's not the only tool in your toolkit.
When we invent all this new value, how do we deal with all that new value? Do we really need it? Should we be frightened about all those new value stuff coming to us?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of changes coming on here. How do we create a social structure that's used to rapid change in people's lives? Not only from the standpoint of consumption, but from the standpoint that their jobs are going to change way more often. You know, I think we have many social structures that are still based around an industrial production model. We probably have a lot of social structures that are based around an industrial distribution model for how we actually sell stuff and get to people. And then we have an industrial life cycle for lifestyle for using things. All of those things are still to be invented. My guess is whatever you think right now is the change that's going to happen, it's going to be one of those things that people will be laughing at later on because you couldn't see such obvious fundamental shifts in the way people are thinking.
So you just gave a talk and you had this example of a connected makeup, you would say. Could you shortly tell us what this connected makeup could look like?
Yeah, so one of the things we're really excited about right now is this idea that there are from time to time, collections of technologies that come together that suddenly like work in synergy with each other. And you get this explosion of innovation. Last time we really saw this was around the mobile phone, where all of a sudden mobile technology brought together a number of different things and boom, you had the whole mobile explosion. The three things that are coming together today are big data, which allows us infinite insight into people's lives. We've got ubiquitous touch, which means we can touch your life anywhere you want. And we have the cloud, which allows various value providers to be connected up to those insights and points of touch. You bring those three together and you can do some really cool stuff. So the example was Sephora and Pantone have created a map of all the colors of a person's skin. And Sephora has a nice little device in their store where they can test the color of your skin and recommend the right makeup. It's kind of neat. It's like a good example of, you know, big data being used to provide an extra consumer value, an example of an innovation. We started playing with that and saying, how would we stretch that using all of this ecosystem of big data, ubiquitous touch, and the cloud to connect things? And we imagine Fernanda, who's one of our designers in New York, coming home. And her calendar has already figured out that she has a party for that, a date that evening. And in addition, the calendar's already gone out and looked at what the weather was, because it has access to the general information in the world. And it's also hopped over to the restaurant building system, because now building systems know about themselves to provide the lighting levels of the restaurant. So it knows that it's going to be raining, that Fernanda has a thing that's going to be after dark, and that the building level lights are going to be such. And when she arrives late, it knows that she's running late. When she pulls a dress out of the closet could announce what kind of dress it was that she had pulled out. Maybe it's the green dress or whatever. And now Fernanda could be guided by her mirror in how to put on the makeup, because we know the conditions, the types of things that she's going to be wearing, etc. Her ubiquitous touch point could be the mirror, actually letting her know what to do. When she gets to the restaurant, if she's sweating or it's dark or whatever, her wearable technology could update that information and on her hand mirror provide her additional advice. Now, that may sound a bit frivolous, but what's interesting about it is it provides a whole lot of points of value that are all basically transparent to Fernanda how they happened. And there's not a store in sight. There's not a retailer in sight. There's none of the traditional industrial players. It's all interwoven with her life. And there's nothing that's technically impossible in it. We could do it today if we set our minds to it for a few days.
Why didn't we do it today?
I don't know. Just there's so much you can do. You know, I think if we wanted to sit down and imagine a new one of those every lunchtime, we could easily do it. And somebody probably is doing it.
So we will see. Thank you very much for the interview. Is there any last words you want to say?
You know, I think I find this the most exciting time to be alive. It's just amazing. We are at the cusp of a point where change is happening in the world at a scale that is almost unimaginable. 50 years from now, people are going to be asking about what it was like to be alive at this moment in history. It's enormously exciting. But as I mentioned before, if we don't get it right, there's going to be a whole lot of disruption going on at the same time.